President Dubois is on the schedule this morning. That would be the partial resurrection of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. I wanted to call it the incomplete resurrection, and that was a little too harsh for me, but on the other hand, partial has two meanings. So anyway, that's my conundrum. Just a couple of statements about, before we kind of get to thinking about the text, of what I'm up to this morning with you all. First of all, I would love for you to, at least if you can, think that we are reading a story, not a history. Or as I said yesterday, one of my main mentors was back in the 1800s, he was a Roman Catholic cardinal and a scripture scholar, and he said to us, thank God that they didn't write down what happened.
Oh.
This is a Roman Catholic cardinal. Thank God they wrote down what it meant to them.
What
it meant to them.
Oh.
In other words, I would propose that just for the moment, I mean, just for this next hour, if you want to try it out, that this is like going to the movies. You know how when the lights go down at the movies, you give yourself into the story. Hardly ever do you ask, did this really happen? You're simply in the middle of the story. I would want to say that this is what Mark wants us to do. Remembering that probably most scholars, and by the way, I have to say this again, whenever I say we know this or we know that about the first century, you just should say underneath your breath, Hal is lying. Because nobody knows what happened in the first century. And I've been at it for 40 years as a full professional, and I like knowing things. But it turns out that the more exact skill is not knowing things. So I would just want you to think that since Mark is probably the first gospel written, I mean, some of us now think that the Gospel of Thomas was earlier, but that doesn't matter because the Gospel of Thomas doesn't have a story and doesn't have a resurrection. So this is almost certainly the first gospel, the first gospel story written, and the first gospel with a resurrection. Somebody yesterday, as we were giving just a snapshot of the Gospel of Mark and what we'd be doing this weekend, somebody said, when was the Gospel of Mark written? And I refused to say, because I wanted to say it today. And so this is one of the few things that scholars agree on. Almost all scholars agree that the Gospel of Mark was written somewhere between 67 and 80 CE, that is, or some of you would call it AD. Between 67 and 80. Now, what's going on there? Just very briefly. So in 67/68, the Roman Empire, which ruled all the countries of the Mediterranean with an iron fist and very violently, they had a transition in who was emperor. And in 68, there was a time in which nobody was emperor. And so what happened then was Egypt, for instance, said, we're going to revolt. And so Rome poured its soldiers into Egypt so that Egypt couldn't rule, because Egypt was really dying. In Israel, tiny little country that Rome also was in charge of or was occupying, Israel saw, oh, nobody's really in charge in Rome. Most of the troops are in Egypt. Let's revolt. And they did it successfully. Little tiny Israel had a successful revolt. So for 2 years out of a period of 300, they were their own country again. Whoa! And then in 70, Rome got its new emperor installed and looked around and said, yeah, we kept everything, except that little place called Israel. Oh, let's go get it back. So they just put all their, they put tons of legions into northern Galilee and marched towards Jerusalem, all of that was free for that time. And Jerusalem had been where the plot and the revolt had started, and was, of course, where the temple was. And so as the Roman legions went through Galilee, they just decimated everything. So, for instance, Josephus, and I said this yesterday, to Josephus, the Jewish first century historian, said that from northern Galilee to Jerusalem, there were crucified people on the road every step of the way on both sides. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people crucified. And of course, just remembering that I've said this also like almost every time I'm here, so the crucifixion is the rule, according to Roman law, is the punishment for leading a revolt. So, in other words, let's hang them up in public and watch them die really slowly so that no one ever tries that again. So this is like that law on steroids, getting back Israel in 70, because they said, let's have 8 or 10,000 crucifixions on the way to Israel. Sometime during, and then you get to Jerusalem, you burn the city down, you destroy the temple, you take all of the relics from the temple and save it for a parade in Rome, you bring the defeated general from Israel side to Rome too, and you forbid the country to be, the city to be rebuilt for the next 40 years. And when you get to Rome with the relics of the temple, the Jewish temple, and the general who led the revolt, as you start the parade into the city with holding up the all of the things that they've just taken from the burned and destroyed temple, the first thing you do is cut the head off the general. What a happy day. So just to get the flavor of violence under the Roman Empire, especially for those people that they are oppressing and occupying. So anyway, we're almost positive that this is when the Gospel of Mark was written. Somewhere right at the end or afterwards. Yesterday I was saying that I'm wanting to read especially the Passion and Resurrection of Mark as a place where healing, loss, and pain mix. So again, just to say a little bit about, before we get into the story, I want to say that Mark was written to people who had just lost their country, their temple, and all, and surely every family in the entire nation had at least one person crucified. So the other thing to say is, after I've got one book on Mark, and it's really my favorite gospel, in or outside the canon, and the thing is, Mark is so complexly written. You can trust every Markan story to have three different levels of meaning, at least three, sometimes two, sometimes five. But it is so densely written. It's written like my mentor said it's supposed to be. It's written for meaning. It's not written for information. Okay, all right. One last thing to say before we get into it. So people don't know Mark very well. It was the first gospel, but it's the least one known. For one reason is it's covered over with Matthew, Luke, and John. That is, hardly any of us can, when we say, now what's the story of blank, that we know exactly what Mark says, right? I actually probably do. But the problem is, therefore, that we lose the author and the authorship. Because we've got Matthew and Luke and John, all of which are different, but all of which are later and probably bouncing off of Mark. So some of Matthew and Luke, especially, and maybe John, are actively trying to write it a little differently than they know Mark wrote it. So we, when we're reading our little, this is the gospel for Sunday, we're completely screwed up, right? We don't really know that we're reading Mark's long story. So I say that Mark is like Shakespeare. You can find three or four or five meanings in every story. But it's much harder if you're just reading it one little thing at a time and then not the rest of it, because it's a real tightly wound story. The one really funny and I think wonderful thing in our post-colonial times is that that Mark has bad grammar. So Mark is like Shakespeare with bad grammar. It's written by someone clearly who has a different native language, but thinks and works like Shakespeare.
What do you mean, different native language?
I mean not Greek. Sorry, thanks. So in other words, Mark is written in Greek, but it's written by somebody who had to learn Greek as a second language.
So you think it's the writing, not the translation?
Yeah, because there's so many word plays in the Greek. I mean, it's just densely alive as Greek, but you can find grammar errors all over the place as well.
He needed an editor.
You know,
or he probably didn't need an editor.
I don't know. I've been reading so much in this post-colonial era. What happens when someone writes a book in English but is not native to it? Mm-hmm. Actually, in many ways, it's actually deeper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that's because they really have to search out what they're trying to say in another language in a lot of ways? So you have to...
Some of that, Peg, but more it's that they mix their language actively and they mix the perspective, and so they invade English.
It's like Tex-Mex. It's like Tex-Mex. If you lived in Texas, you...
Or Spanglish.
Spanglish. Spanglish might be better than Tex-Mex. Yes.
And actually, if any of you know, for instance, people, Indian people, mm-hmm. listen to them talk. It's like every seventh word, there's an English word there. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, the post-colonial reality is actually richer, even with its, by and large, it's richer even with its errors and grammar.
My sister's mother-in-law wanted me to edit her stories, which she had written. She's German, and she wanted to make it American, and it adds to the texture if you have to try and figure out, oh, what did that mean?
Right.
Yeah.
So, for instance, we're pretty sure that Mark was born into an Aramaic language world, as was Jesus and all of the people in Galilee, at least, because there are a few words in Aramaic.
Yeah.
Aramaic. Yeah. Aramaic. And
he translates them, doesn't he? Usually, he said.
Usually, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as if
it says in Aramaic this, and then it yeah. How about location? I don't know if that really matters, but I was always taught that they thought, you know, in the old days, they said that was probably Rome. That sounds like maybe not Rome,
well,
from what you're saying.
Yeah, John, that's...
or is that just...
Again, yeah. This is the, where, whatever I say, I'm probably lying.
Yes.
I too was in that era, and I would say, but most scholars say either Antioch in Syria...
Okay.
Or,
I've heard that.
Or Galilee.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Yes,
Christy.
I'm sorry.
Do they think it was really a guy named Mark, or is it somebody in the tradition of Mark, or is it just one guy, or is it a bunch of people writing down some sayings?
Okay, now I've got you on the wrong level because you're asking really interesting questions, but let me answer. the word Mark doesn't occur in the Gospel of Mark. The word Mark does not occur in the Gospel of Mark. That is, there's no somebody saying, hey, I'm Mark, and I'm writing this story. Actually, that's true also of Matthew and Luke, right? So we don't know who wrote it. The Gospel of Mark is the title of the book in some of the ancient manuscripts. But the very earliest manuscripts don't have any title. So somebody decided, and the people in the ancient world, so in other words, titles don't matter to ancient writers, nor do they ever care whether they get credit for the book. The persons who make up the titles for each book, and this is Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, etc., right? Mary, Thomas, and so on. Those are all later, probably between 2 and 4 generations later, and they're made by the copyists. Because, you know, they're copying this book, they're copying that book, and they don't want to get them mixed up. And most of them are thoughtless titles. In other words, I'm doing this job, let me just put this up. Okay, now, to the story. Let's start the story, because the title is about resurrection. I'd like to just have us look a little bit at the death of Jesus, too. So, let's turn to chapter 15 towards the end. I got something called the Lutheran Study Bible. You can't understand it. Just kidding.
Which chapter is that? 15?
15.
Oh, thank you. I'll get one. Okay. Here's one.
What's that?
Yeah, the Spanish one is good.
Oh, I brought the Spanish one in. Wait. I can't step over there. Oh, yeah, here we go. Okay, so let's start let's start with the death of Jesus. That would be 1533. And so Jesus is already on the cross. And Jesus hasn't said anything yet from the cross. So I'm going to read my translation here to begin, but let's read through, let's read 33 to 39, and I'll start and someone else will pick up. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land and until 3 in the afternoon. At 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Someone else pick up there?
When some of the bystanders heard it, they said, "Listen, he is calling for Elijah." And someone ran, filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." Then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last.
Someone else?
And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now when the centurion, who stood facing him, saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was God's son."
Thanks. We'll stop there for a moment. Just notice some other things about this here. So, by the way, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani is Aramaic. But so Jesus is dying, and then he's dead, right? We just went and got him dead. Jesus says one thing on the cross. And what is that?
My God, my God,
why have you forsaken me or abandoned me is another interesting translation. All right, so how's Mark Jesus feeling on the cross?
Pretty crabby.
Mad and abandoned, yeah. Right?
Just like probably all those crucified Jewish people.
Yeah, right, and that's the idea.
From Galilee to Jerusalem.
Congratulations, Romans, on getting this torture right. Because it makes you think like you've gone crazy and you've lost everything. Now some of you know this next thing, but it's not on the page. My God, why have you abandoned me? Is somewhere else in the Bible.
Psalm 22.
We're not going to turn to that because I got too many things to do. Psalm 22 is a great psalm, and it's about abandonment. And it starts with this phrase. And again, here I'm probably lying, but a bunch of us who've been reading Psalm 22 are pretty sure that we know what the story is. It's about someone crying out to God because he's lost everything. But when we look carefully, we're pretty sure that the person who is crying out to God, having lost everything, is a debtor. What we know about the, he's lying again. What we know about the agricultural population in ancient Israel is that it's not working well because the peasants keep getting in debt to the city people. It's not real good agricultural territory. And you have to go in debt, like, you know, when I was a rancher, when my family was a rancher, we kept going in debt in the mountain. And we kept going to the local bank to borrow so that we could get the seed and the money to dip the next crop in the ground. But if it wasn't a good year, this is the same thing things happening in Israel. And so what happens is the city folks foreclose on the peasants in Israel. And you remember that thing, which is also in some of the stories of of Jesus, but come straight from Psalm 22, and they cast lot for my clothes. That's because there's too many debtors and not enough money. They even take his clothes, but they have to see who gets the clothes, who gets a little bit of more money or something. In other words, that's what's happening in Psalm 22, right? So, and then at the end of Psalm 22, the voice changes. It's no longer, I, the debtor, have lost everything, God. Why are you paying attention? Read Psalm 22, it's amazing. But it looks like so many people got Psalm 22, really wanted to pray the Psalm 22 because so many people were in debt and losing everything. Did they put it in the temple liturgy? But when they put it in the temple liturgy, they thought, this is kind of a downer. Because all this guy is doing is yelling at God. You know, by the way, the Psalms are really great about that, right? Yeah. They're not like politically correct. They are yelling at God about a third of the time. They're saying, hey, kill that guy over there, God. In other words, this is not like theology, it's just, this is the gut coming out. But, so the temple crowd, this is in ancient Israel, the temple crowd thinks that it's probably not good enough language, so they add a happy ending. In which, in the third person, not the first person, God will remember the poor. No one will ever have not enough to eat. God is going to give a new people, and they're all going to be saved.
Yeah.
So, notice what, I mean, on one level in Mark, Jesus, the only thing he says is, God, why did you abandon me? And that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. On another level, this is the second and third level of meaning in Mark, he's quoting Psalm 22 about all of the people in Israel who've lost everything. Notice how that connects to what happened in Jerusalem under the Romans. And if you want to read it that way, you get the happy ending. In Jesus' scream at God, you could say he's citing Psalm 22, including the happy ending in the third person. Now, I don't frankly want us to decide which meaning is right. I want to say this stuff is so good, both or all three of the meanings are right. Mm-hmm. Now, heavier territory. We've got Jesus dead, crying out, maybe something good's going to happen eventually. Now, let's reread that verse 39. Now when the centurion who was facing him saw this in this way, he breathed his last, saying, truly this man was God's son. By the way, okay, just a little translation thing. In many of your translations you'll find it, truly this man was the son of God.
Yes.
Anybody have that?
Mm-hmm.
Wrong. It's wrong Greek. It does not say this was the son of God. It says this one was a son of God. The Greek doesn't have the son of God. But of course, the doctrinal crowd of Christianity wants this to be the son of God.
Chosen article.
Article means everything here, right?
Isn't that fascinating?
So, but let me now. I'm going to take another little step aside. Just want to say some other thing about Mark. And by the way, would you please just say, "Hey, I've got a question," or "I've got an argument." three things about Mark. Jesus basically is acclaimed Son of God in three places in Mark, and it's beautifully structured. In the beginning, mm-hmm. Who calls Jesus, Son of God.
God!
Mm-hmm. Right? In
the baptism.
In the baptism. Now, here's the cool thing. This is just so amazing. In Mark, not in Matthew or Luke, in Mark, it's only Jesus that sees the sky opening and hears the voice. Only Jesus. So, but that's the first time Jesus is Son of God. Second time is a transfiguration, in which Jesus and the disciples, some of the disciples go up, and then there's Moses and Elijah up there too, right? Mm-hmm. And the three big guys are enlightened, literally. And there, this time is not just Jesus that hears the thing from the sky, but everybody, I mean, that is Moses, Elijah, and the three disciples, they all see it too. So this is, in other words, this is, Mark is letting it sink in. Jesus is Son of God. This is the third time. Yes, John.
You're wrong about one thing.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Now, in the context of the story of Jesus, those are the three times, but the first line of the gospel is the beginning
right.
of the good news
right.
of Jesus Christ. Yeah. Now, here's what I want to know, because I haven't looked at my Greek, is the article there. And when it says Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is how we translate it in Mark 1:1.
I can't remember.
Neither can I. Okay. We can probably go over there.
Now the third time, and the fight, so in other words, Mark is actually structured for the middle is Jesus the Son of God, the beginning is Jesus the Son of God, the end is Jesus the Son of God. Who called Jesus the Son of God at the end?
The
centurion. Who is a centurion?
It's a Roman.
Roman soldier. That's not quite. I mean, that's only half the answer.
Gentile?
No. Well, yes.
Yes.
But centurion. Anybody know what centurion means? It's got the word 100 in it.
100. The leader of 100.
He's the leader of 100 soldiers. Mm-hmm. Now. So, what is his role at the crucifixion? What is the commander of 100? What is his role in the story of the crucifixion? He's the boss.
Mm-hmm.
He's in charge.
Just to see it completed.
He's the boss. So here's the thing that. Maybe, you know, a bunch of us are just thinking about for the last 20 years. So this translation is, surely, this man was God's son. This man was a son of God. Those are the two translations.
Why did he say that? Because it got dark?
So that's my question. What would you think? Because it was dark, and it was scary, and maybe caused them. Yeah, maybe. Let's first remember that there are three dramatic God signs in Mark, when they named them. So this is a big deal. But this is the person who just killed Jesus, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's the leader. He's the commander. Now, in Greek, in our translation, in our manuscripts of Greek, here's really one thing that is very important to know. And you know, you already know that I'm lying half of the time. But here is the thing about Greek is Greek, as we find it in the manuscripts, has no punctuation. No capitalization and no separation between the words. So you look at the original, not there isn't an original Mark, the very early Mark, and that it's just It's like a real long line of letters. You have to find out where one word ends and the next one. But most important, there's no punctuation. So, just try this out. If you're the commander of a crucifixion, your job is to humiliate. Right? That's the purpose of the law, is to humiliate. So, a bunch of us are saying, wrong punctuation mark. And the translation really is, God's Son? Really? This is a mocking. What I'm going to suggest is that this is best understood on one level of the commander saying, look at the great job I did. You know, there's already been mocking in the story. He said, God's Son, really? He just yelled at God about being abandoned.
And died.
In the most excruciating manner possible, with imperfect Roman scenario, with a whole bunch of people watching. So, I want to say that just in terms of the story, this is a mocking commander doing his job. But, hold on, Christy, 1 minute. But it can't be just that in Mark. Because we already have heard God say secretly to Jesus, God's Son, and to the little group on top of the mountain, God's Son. All in the same, by the way, all with not the Son of God, but a Son of God. So, we know that there's another meaning. So this is a scheming commander who is declaring victory. At the same time, the roots of the story say we know something else. As readers, we know something else. Right? We know about the Transfiguration, and we know about it. And even though only Jesus knows in the story, but we're readers, we know it. This, of course, is clear too, and this is the other thing I'm setting up for us. This is clear that there are all kinds of secrets in Mark. Jesus has a lot of them. Every time somebody is healed, or somebody identifies him as from God, Jesus' response is, don't tell anyone. Remember that part of the gospel in which we
secret.
Why is that going on? And every time Jesus says, don't tell anyone, what do the people do?
It's like telling a kid not to get into cooking.
Okay, I just set up, we're going to get there in a little bit, I just set up what I call the best punchline in ancient literature. That's the picture there. I'm going to skip over for a moment so we can do some other work on all of this. I want to skip over the burial and get to the resurrection. The resurrection or the empty tomb story in 1-8. Some of you heard this briefly yesterday. But not the way we're going to go at it, because we just did what we did. So here's what happens. Well, no, let's read it. 1-8. Who hasn't read it? Oh, and let me just say, you have to look in your Bible. Where does chapter 16 end? Two endings? Somebody have two endings?
Yeah, it says two.
Anybody have more than two endings? Yep.
Yeah.
There are three endings.
Four, and then you even throw in one. We got the ascension of Jesus in there.
Right, right. So there are three or four endings in one. These are different manuscripts. Hmm. I have the ending, the formal ending at verse 8. And as we said yesterday, all of the earliest manuscripts of Mark end at 8. 16:8 is the last word in the Gospel of Mark for at least the first 250 years of manuscript. The later ones, and by the way, it's kind of early when you have a manuscript in the 4th century, because many of what we are based on are in the 8th and 9th century. So, let's read from one day. Who wants to start?
I'll start.
Thank you.
When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?"
Someone else?
And looking up, they saw that the stone was rolled back. It was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were amazed. And he said to them, "Do not be amazed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him as he told you." And they went out and they fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
End of gospel. Let's let that sink in for a minute. So here in the earliest versions of Mark, the first narrative gospel, it ends with the empty tomb, sort of walk through. There's Jesus is not there, neither are any disciples. That kind of fits with Mark, by the way, because in Mark, the disciples are always doing the wrong thing. Even at Jesus' crucifixion, they're only the faithful women. So women are there, they go in, and there's a young man. If we had more time, I'd point out that there's another young man in Mark's story that this is related to, probably. But then the young man says, "Not here." Yeah, he was lying right here. I see that. But he's not here. He is risen. And he's going to Galilee, where he said he would meet you. The women, who are already known in two ways, by the way. One is they're the ones who stay close to Jesus. They're the ones who, in chapter 15, will say they're the ones that actually gave him financial support. They are so amazed and so afraid that they run away and say nothing to anyone. So, if you were of this mind, and weren't as pious as you are. Sorry, just teasing. You would start laughing, at least in a dark way, because what has Jesus been saying the whole story?
Don't tell anybody.
Don't tell anybody. Mm-hmm. Finally, someone didn't tell. I mean, that is huge irony, right? Kept saying to tell, and now when we need them to tell the most.
The young man tells them to go tell.
Yeah, right.
But they don't.
So now when we most need them, to tell they don't, which is kind of like obeying Jesus. Right? Jesus has been saying for the whole story, don't tell, and they do. This is the first time where they really need to be telling, and they don't. Now we need to just think about this as what I was saying is a really good story if you've just lost your people, members of your family, your temple, and maybe your religion.
There are no words to describe that.
Was Jesus raised in this story?
He says he is.
Yes. I mean, it's clear. Mm-hmm. Jesus was raised, or at least a second-hand story, right?
Right.
Jesus was raised.
Somebody could have stolen him.
Huh?
Somebody could have
stolen him. Exactly. Because, by the way, that's one of the main things that happens, especially between the people of Israel and Romans, because you need to get the guy buried quickly. And because the Romans, what they prefer is that you leave the dead man on the cross and you watch the dogs and the birds eat the body. So it's pretty famous for the people of Jerusalem to want to get that body and take it away somewhere. But here we more or less get a resurrection, but no one ever knows. So for instance, this, if you've read Mark, in which the disciples are always screwing up, especially Peter, it's not hard to say, well, it is or that. Meaning, not to know. But who else knows? Remember?
The reader knows.
Yeah, you do.
They wrote this, the reader was in on the
joke.
Yeah,
the readers know this. They know, same thing. No one, I mean, at this baptism, no one knew except we did because we were ancient. So, in other words, now the ancient reader knows that God whispered to Jesus at his baptism, "You're my son." And a few people knew at the Transfiguration. That same idea even occurred in the mockingness of the centurion.
The question that always comes to my mind is, how did the writer know? If Jesus was the only one who heard,
well, remember what I said? You may not have been here when we started. Think of this as a story. Don't think of this as history. Just for a moment, think, so how about this being a really amazingly told story? So yes, the reader knows, but I want to suggest that the writer knows, but the writer doesn't want to tell us what happened. Wants to tell us what it means. And the meanings to be addressed here are what happens when you and your people have lost everything. And what I want to say is an incomplete resurrection. Partial resurrection is the only possibility. So we started this yesterday a little bit, and I want to deepen it. So as a pastor, when I have been in that role, and someone says, I meet with, let's say, a couple who just lost their 3-year-old son or daughter. So for my first 8 or 10 years of being a pastor, I gave them a pep talk. I said, things will be better. It's not so bad. what a terrible job I was doing. Because I gradually knew that that was an insult to them, mm-hmm. that they're lost. Mm-hmm. And so what I now do is just sit beside and be with them in the middle of the loss. So I want to say this is what Mark's doing. And as I said yesterday, I proposed that Mark is a story that refuses to have life be tragic and refuses to have life be triumphal. Because what the readers have experienced is not triumphant. They're more drawn to probably thinking it's tragic. But what you have here is a carefully layered description of the resurrection in which it happened, but underwhelmingly.
What?
Underwhelmingly. Now, let me just give a bigger picture of Mark. So Mark as a story overall fits so well with this. It's just the right kind of tone for what's happening throughout Mark. And that, and let me just mention a couple of things about. So Mark has broken bodies everywhere. Mm-hmm. And has Jesus as a relatively successful healer. So I would want to say, the main thing Jesus does in Mark is heal. And almost always it's people who are poor, disheartened, or terribly tortured in one way or another. The thing is, in Mark, it doesn't always work. So if you want to look at it, look at chapter 6, in which he goes to Nazareth.
Yeah.
And he can't do any miracle. Or the thing I love about is, you know, there are two stories of a healing of the blind man, of a blind man. Mm-hmm. For me, the most marked of it is, so Jesus heals this one blind man, and the blind man comes back and says, I think something's wrong. It looks like trees walking. Jesus says, whoops. works it again and does it again. So in other words, Mark's Jesus is a healer and a very significant one. And someone, oh, by the way, the other thing that happens in chapter 6 is after Jesus can't heal, guess who does heal? The disciples. So Mark is also an incomplete healer. A good one?
Jesus, sorry.
Yeah. So this I would want to suggest for us too may be appropriate. That is, what if we decided to really live into this story? In which there's very substantial healing. There is resurrection, but you can't count on either all the time.
And it's a secret.
It's a secret.
That's interesting.
Well, say a little bit more, Susan.
Well, I just mean it's a secret of the people who've read it. It's a secret of the people who've told the story to one another. It isn't for everybody. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and thank you for the other level of ambiguity. Who are, I mean, even if, I mean, in one way, the women are the witnesses, right? Mm-hmm. It's, the story's not a happy witnessing. But the other thing we need to know is, according to Roman and Jewish law, guess who doesn't count in court?
Women.
Right.
It really didn't matter.
Women.
Well, and Luke's gospel goes to the point of saying we didn't really, it was an idle tale because women told it.
Right. Yes. Exactly. That's what, in Luke, The apostles say,
yeah.
Wait a minute. By the way, I don't think Mark is slandering the women, because the women are always the ones when the disciples screw up. The women are the ones who know.
Yeah.
There was a hand over here. Yes, please.
Okay, when in the proper translation, it's Jesus is a son of God.
Yes.
Does that imply there are other sons of God?
Nice question. I think Mark wants that question on the table. Not in some kind of anti-Christian way, but just for the, see, in other words, here, the reason that Jesus is who he is in Mark is because he's the pattern, he's the model for everybody else who just lost everything. Mm-hmm. In other words, Mark, Jesus, isn't the Nicene Jesus. Mm-hmm. Mark's Jesus is the one who is close to you in the middle of your disaster. So that means that you should associate with Jesus. So maybe you are too. So the plural there simply allows the overlap of Jesus and the Jesus people. And that's also kind of lets us off the hook, because Jesus screws up in a time or two.
I'm going to take that one over there.
One man stayed in a relationship and asked again. And that seems important to me, that if we don't get it the first time, we can say, what?
Yeah, right.
It's okay to ask again. I find Mark to be the most realistic of the human condition. And I think that's what you're trying to say in a lot of ways. Is because there is, we have that message that we are God's chosen. That's given to us in our baptism.
Right. Well, it's right out of Paul.
Right, right. And
our being children of God is like being Jesus.
Yes, but don't expect this triumphal lifestyle that Joel Osteen and all the rest of that glory bunch are selling. Because if you're, I mean, when you've lost it all, when you've, 2 weeks after, 2 weeks after I got to my church in Boise, I had a woman in my congregation who was abducted, raped and murdered, and left out in upstream. And we didn't discover her body for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And there was no way you could speak anything other than, my God, why have you forsaken me? Mm-hmm. And I'm so thankful that I was not that within my first 5 years of being a pastor.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because I would have done the same thing. I would have said, you're going to get through this. You would have, I just said nice platitudes instead of saying, this sucks.
Right, yeah.
And this is not where, And Mark does that better than I think Matthew, Luke, and John does.
So what I said yesterday was, I'm hoping that our time together this weekend with each of the texts is a way of thinking about uneven healing, loss, joy, and trauma in the same breath. And what I invited us to do yesterday was to, before we did anything, we took a deep breath and said, how are things going for us in our life right now? So that we can open up the possibility of uneven combination of joy, healing, loss, and trauma. And I want to say, of the four canonical Gospels, Mark's your best friend if you got some things going wrong. We'll see, this afternoon, we'll see a piece from early Christ movements that's not in the Bible that is, I think, Mark's best friend. Similarly, uneven, powerful healing attached to near tragedy.
It's almost asking us to live in a paradox.
It is.
Yeah. And the presence that it has is extra real. Mm-hmm. And also, feels to me like holds us accountable in terms of not deciding on tragedy and not deciding on triumphalism.
Mark's gospel seems a stark contrast to John's, where Mark really emphasizes the humanity of Jesus, mentions that he's got brothers and sisters and everything,
right. Yeah.
Where John is emphasizing the divinity of Jesus.
Yeah, and we're going to look at John this afternoon a little bit too, by the way, in a way that stays with that observation and also nuances it a bit. I know I'm over time, I'm going to just say one more thing relative to that. I guess I want to say that I think the divinity of Jesus is really powerful in Mark. It's just, in other words, Mark doesn't ever dodge Jesus as child of God. It's just, it's a different kind of participation in divinity. So for me, this is an invitation into participation in and presence with divine divinity. But it's very complicated and nuanced in how that is real in lives that may be broken. I've always tried to end on time, and I've already failed. 4 o'clock this afternoon for anybody who wants.
Thank you, Alex.